The History of the United States Podcast, Episode 46. We won the war. What was it all for? Hamilton to Burr in Hamilton, an American Musical. What do we mean by the revolution? The war? That was no part of the revolution. It was only an effect and consequence of it. John Adams. Hello. Welcome in. Welcome back. And here we are. The war is over. Before we get to the politics of peace, and there are always politics involved with peace, let's take a breath for a second. It's time to do the history thing for a cast. What did it all mean? So many times when we talk about history or imagine history, it's a series of dates and places and people and events and all strung together in a nice chronological order. Just the facts, ma'am, to quote Dragnet. But the discipline of history demands really more than that. It's the reason we study history, more than simply report it. Historians aren't scribed, though we often get perceived that way. So what was this war between 1775 and 1783, when the treaty was made it all official? Was it a revolution? Was it a rebellion? A war of independence? Many historians have come down on all sides of this discussion. After reading some of the greatest hits in this regard, I've come to the conclusion that the war and all that surrounds it means different things to different people. Not just the historians writing about it years, decades, and centuries later, but the war meant different things to various people who were most affected by it at that time. For some, it was a great boon, political rights bestowed that had hitherto never been realized. A real sense of identity was established for many new citizens in a new nation. For others, it wasn't just a continuation of the status quo, but a disappointment. Yes, those that stayed loyal to the empire had a rough go of it, but others lost as well. Slaves, who saw the British Empire as their best course to freedom, were left without much recourse at all. Women, who experienced a measure of independence that they had never had, were expected to recede back to their formal roles. The tensions that these shortfalls created made for a society that was changed by 8 years of conflict. But as we understand revolutions and rebellions, how far did the American Revolution really go? When the war ended, those that had the greatest power in the state legislature retained those positions. The Continental government was still for politicians of a more aristocratic bent. The main components of the economy were still in the hands of those that controlled them prior. A more or less landed gentry in the South, a greater mercantile, financial and manufacturing concerns in the North. The hopes, expectations, and very real democratic dreams of the other classes, the middling sort, yeomen farmers and mechanics, were present. But did they gain voice with the conclusion of the war? For those on the losing side, it was a big transition. Final estimates put the number of loyalists to be around 500,000, or about 20% of those living in the United States. About one-fifth of those relocated to Canada or Great Britain during the war. Some of those that left later returned, but it wasn't an easy re-entry, olly-olly oxen-free. Lands owned by the Crown and Loyalists were confiscated during the war and auctioned off. While there were Loyalists from all social strata, a large number came from the upper class, especially those that worked within and close to the royal government. Where once they had prestige and property, they were now lucky if they could retain even some of their belongings. And it wasn't just the physical aspects, the property loss or the political, the loss of government power that Loyalists faced, but a new social world as well. After the war, soldiers now turned citizens still wanted and demanded the respect they had earned in the war. This was no professional army like that of Great Britain, where deference to the gentleman officer corps was reflected in the general society. Nope. American soldiers took the idea of all men created equal to heart. The ideal of egalitarianism was flushed throughout the countryside. those especially from the middling ranks, had little regard for those that were once considered their superiors. The wartime economy and subsequent post-war economy helped to promote this emerging class. As you might have surmised, imports and trade with Great Britain, which were already taking a hit leading up to the war, were pretty much non-existent during the war. Well, fighting a war takes more than guns and generals, and American manufacturing, by necessity, had to pick up the slack. Once the war ended, these new manufacturing interests, can't call them titans of industry just yet, were very keen on protecting their interests. Talk of trade and tariff were a part of the national political landscape from the beginning. And while the ports would always be important, there was a greater emphasis on trading within the country and out to the West than there was necessarily going back to Europe. This middling sort of merchants and manufacturers represented a multitude of ideas about republicanism and equality. The creation of a military honorary order, the Society of Cincinnati, was seen by many, including Sam Adams, as an attempt to establish a hereditary military class. In fact, private clubs and fancy dress, once seen as a calling card of authority, now became demerits to the population when looking for leadership. Another interesting parallel today. Until recently, in politics, Americans did not like it when political candidates displayed or spoke of their wealth. Of course, that has really changed. As then-candidate Trump once said, "I'm really rich." Oddly enough, though I'm guessing you can figure out I'm not a big fan of our current president, in this case, I find it a bit refreshing. Though I have doubts about how really rich he is, but that's for another time. It's just that so many of our political candidates, just to limit it to the presidency for a second, have been, in no uncertain terms, very, very wealthy. At least we didn't have to see Donald Trump in camo, in a vain attempt to look working class or common. Nope, President Trump doesn't just own being rich, he brags about it. There were calls from some to do away with all the distinctions. While not everyone was quite that radical, some changes reflected this attitude in broad terms. Ordinary citizens now insisted on being called Mr. or Mrs., titles formerly granted to those of a more aristocratic bent. Many workers, especially those working for artisans, did not like the idea of calling their employer master. Instead, they were employees, not beholden to their employer in the fashion of en loco parentis. In local churches, the custom of assigning seats in church based on family standing was all but abandoned. To quote Gordon S. Wood, one of the eminent historians of the American Revolution, "For many Americans, living in a free country meant not having to tip your cap to anyone." End quote. This new egalitarianism wasn't welcomed by everyone, as you could guess. There was, and for years to come, among the most influential, wealthy, and connected Americans, the idea of a natural aristocracy. These were the men, and of course it was always men, who, by their birth, education, and wealth, were the best to lead in society and government. Class division would be discussed for years to come, throughout much of what will be called the Federalist era as we now approach it. Funny, in all those discussions, though, that you can go back and read, there wasn't much discussion of class warfare, unlike today, where the mere mention of the well-to-do helping the poor sends many into a dither about the impending class war. However, much like today, those with wealth and power didn't face that much of a threat. As in 1776, by the time a peace was achieved in 1783, close to half of all the wealth in the new country was consolidated into the hands of the upper class. Even the upper class embraced one of the most significant social changes in the post-revolutionary world: the commitment to education. It was clear that the fight for independence was more than a struggle on the battlefield. It was fought with letters, pamphlets, speeches, and laws. No document until the writing of the Constitution would be revered like the Declaration of Independence. And to truly appreciate this cornerstone of American independence, being able to read it was paramount. Nothing demonstrates this commitment to education like the provision within the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, setting aside a portion of public land within all districts expressly for education. More to the point, it was public education, not religious education, like the first schools and universities in North America. Speaking of colleges and universities, in 1776, there were only 9 in the United States. Within the next 25 years, 16 schools would be added. Schools were only one method toward making a new ideal Republican country. Public money was also devoted to public libraries in an effort to encourage more reading. Though private libraries were still superior, like Thomas Jefferson's library at Monticello, the devotion of public resources to the act of reading promoted reading clubs, debate societies, and other public educational events. Other learned societies focused on other disciplines and sprang up in all the major cities, and even out into the countryside. A flood of magazines were published shortly after the war, and of note, Noah Webster's first speller, the precursor to the famed dictionary, was published first in 1783. The greatest beneficiaries of this explosion of learning were, as you could probably guess, white men and boys. But white women made significant strides in the New Republic as well. The role of the mother was seen as vital, not only in the moral education of children, but in the public education as well, meaning gaining a greater understanding of the world outside the home. Republican motherhood was the ideal for raising children, especially boys, to become good citizens and leaders of this new republic. Those daughters raised by Republican mothers were afforded rights that their mothers never had. Female children were now considered in matters of inheritance, and the legal right to pursue a divorce, enter into contracts, and even conduct business were recognized. While not always recognized locally, many of the barriers to women in legal matters were officially, at the very least, removed. As women's legal status grew, the importance of female education became apparent. In the 20 years after the Revolution, academies for the express purpose of educating girls were established. My suspicion was that these schools were founded almost exclusively in New England and New York, was only partially correct. Though the majority of them were in that particular area, there were also women's schools founded in the South and to the West in that post-revolutionary time frame. The trend of women's advancement was nationwide, not as provincial as my earlier bias assumed. More on this as well as we get into the discussion of the early republic. Much of this is a continuation of the trend we discussed during the war. With men off to fight, women had to take up the task of running the family business or farm. When the men came back, many of the wives and daughters didn't want to go back to their old roles. Sometimes, knowing that they were out of touch or worse, now incapable, many men left the running of the family concern to women. Much is made of Abigail Adams and her concerns about women's rights, expressed in her letters to her husband, John. And rightly so. Abigail Adams' writings give us insight, if only to the most upper of the upper class. The thoughts and concerns of women in the revolutionary and post-revolutionary era. Even more prolific, however, was another upper-class woman. Mercy Otis Warren, a close friend of the Adams, not only expressed in letters, but in public essays. Otis Warren expressed the concerns for women, but also demonstrated a keen legal mind on various issues, especially the debate over the ratification of the Constitution. But more on that later. White middle to upper class women saw significant changes from the pre-revolutionary time to the post-revolutionary era. African Americans had a decidedly more mixed bag of it. Tens of thousands of slaves were freed by the British Army, and officially 9,000 of them served in that army. When the army left, it left many of those African Americans with little else besides that freedom. Some emigrated to Canada and others to Europe, but the vast majority stayed in the United States, even in the South. The ideas that were bandied about before and during the Revolution weren't lost on slaves and some slaveholders. The ideas of all being equal, of escaping tyranny, of liberty, encouraged about 5,000 African Americans to take up arms for the United States in hopes of achieving freedom for themselves. Many who held slaves also began to doubt the justice of doing so. At the forefront of this, even before the war, was Pennsylvania. It became apparent to the Quakers, who still held significant sway in Pennsylvania, and other states in the North, that the institution of slavery went against the beliefs they held about human equality. If all people had a divine light within, as the Quakers believed, then slavery was an abomination to that divinity. By 1779, Quaker slaveholders had freed 80% of their slaves. Throughout the North, especially in New England, slavery was being phased out. In the South, there were some changes, but slavery was still a key part of the economy. How long it would be a part of the economy was the question. The model practiced by so many planters, especially in Virginia, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson among them, was hardly sustainable. It relied on ever-expanding land holdings, planting even more, especially tobacco, which then required more labor, and then more land to work to make up the cost of all this new labor and land purchases, not to mention the maintenance of an aristocratic lifestyle. That famed library and wine cellar at Monticello cost quite a bit. It explains why, with all these factors, Thomas Jefferson, for the better part of his adult life, was always in debt. However, even knowing that the system was deeply flawed, the idea of ending slavery was absurd to most Southerners. In his work on the travels of Lewis and Clark, Undaunted Courage, Stephen Ambrose, or one of his grad students, or some other author, I kid, paints a vivid picture of Jefferson and his attitude. While Jefferson believed in equality, it was an equality of a very select few. He saw Native Americans as deeply flawed, but worthy of some respect, especially when dealing with the U.S. government. But he held no such regard for African Americans. He did not believe they were redeemable, capable of learning, let alone governing. Jefferson did not believe that Phyllis Wheatley wrote her own poems, and insisted that a white author was responsible. When confronting this kind of thinking from the person who wrote the Declaration of Independence, it brings into sharp focus how far the United States had to go, and still has to go, on the idea of racial justice. If the Revolution was a decidedly mixed bag, leaning towards a crappy bag for African Americans, it's pretty much sucked for Native Americans. From the conflict starting with the Seven Years' War way back in 1756 until the end of the American War of Independence, at least the fighting part of it in 1781, the population of Native Americans east of the Mississippi was reduced by almost half. Bear in mind, this is a half of the population that was reduced already from all the disease and whatnot that had hurt Native Americans before that. So the numbers just keep on dwindling. As just mentioned, the expansion of agriculture, especially in the South, demanded more land being taken to the West. Population increase and the desire for land ownership also propelled people in the North and East to push further west, all movement putting greater pressure on Native Americans. Making things even more dire for the Native Americans, most of the indigenous people in North America sided with the British. When the war ended and the peace negotiated, Native Americans saw their fate handed over to the new nation, a nation that was either suspicious or openly hostile towards them, depending on the situation. George Rogers Clark, who I mentioned in a couple of casts as the great general out west, expected that the Native Americans would be totally wiped out within a generation. While the new Confederation Congress tried to treat Native Americans as a foreign, if conquered, power, most of the power in the new country rested with the states, who ignored treaties made by the Congress, In turn, some settlers ignored the treaties made by the states. Eventually, Native Americans disregarded all the treaties as well, because, well, nobody's looking at them anyway, so why? Native Americans also tried to join together in their own associations and confederations in an effort to resist white advancement. This may have seemed logical, but in the eyes of the United States, it was seen as an act of aggression, leading to unfortunate and, sadly, inevitable conflicts. And so back to that original question. How revolutionary was the American Revolution? For those at the top of American society, it was pretty extraordinary. A nation was created out of nothing, more or less an idea. That idea would get, and I would say is still getting, refined. But ideas that among the nations of Europe anyway were seen as radical, if not dangerous. It is that notion of the shot heard round the world. Those that fought in the war not only fired and suffered real shots, but heard that more philosophical one as well. They were more than just soldiers. They were citizens. When the fighting was over, they demanded all that citizenship could afford them. If a person, a man really, a white man really, had a trade and some money, the world looked much different than it had in 1776. A society that once seemed very regimented and very structured, at least to those men, looked very open. But that middling sort were only given so much access to governance. Those that worked the levers of power, wealthy landowners in the South, prosperous, also often landed business owners in the North and middling states, saw themselves as the natural aristocracy. In theory, those like Thomas Jefferson idealized the yeoman farmer. In practice, it was far more complicated. As much as the leaders of the Revolution feared and railed against tyranny of the monarch, they were equally distrustful of the mob, and they were not about to let the new nation fall prey to either extreme if they could help it. Those in that popular mob gained much less than those at the top. In some cases, nothing at all. As far as other members of society, women, African Americans, and Native Americans, the Revolution provided little or nothing. Yet, as I finished reading the outstanding novel, The Underground Railroad, the Declaration of Independence became more than a promise, but a goal. It is still the standard that the United States reveres, if not holds itself to, at least some of the time. While the Declaration is not a legal document, it still acts as a contract for the citizens of the United States, and many throughout the world. The Declaration and the war that followed was an event of vast consequences, greater for some than others, both positive for those already in power, and negative, the reality Native Americans found themselves in after the war. To those that could afford to dream about liberty and freedom and social advancement, the Revolution was the great catalyst. For others, circumstances changed very little, if at all. The expectations, however, did change. And other revolutionary ideas and movements await us as we continue the History of the United States podcast. Thank you very much for listening. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, please feel free to drop me an email at kaufmak@yahoo.com. I love interacting with listeners. And until next time, take care.